It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We meet a prolific children's author in Port Washington who's inspired by the beauty of Lake Michigan. Barbara Josie has written more than 55 books that have been translated into 29 languages, and her new one, it's called Death's Door, True Tales of Tragedy, Mystery, and Bravery from the Great Lakes' Most Dangerous Waters. Call in with a question or comment for the children's author, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Barbara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning.
Good morning. Your new graphic novel depicts these five true stories of events in Death's Door. And if you, you know, Death's Door, this passage between the tip of Door County Peninsula and the nearby islands, what do you hope children learn from Death's Door?
Well, I hope they learn that nature is what it is. You don't get to change nature. You need to adapt to it. And I hope they learn that people from long ago aren't so very different from them. I try to relate the situation from people centuries previous to things that kids are feeling and experiencing now, so it doesn't feel so remote.
Why is Death's Door known to be such a dangerous passage?
It's a combination of a lot of different things. Well, Lake Michigan, we have more shipwrecks in Lake Michigan than any of the other Great Lakes. So there's that. I mean, there's a lot of danger on the lake itself. But now the passage has rocks beneath the surface. And of course, the water rises and it lowers. So you really never know where those treacherous areas are. And the wind as well can blow through there like a demon. And that makes that passage really tough.
And in doing your research on Death's Door, you actually went out on a kayak tour so you could get closer to it and experience it yourself. What was that like?
Well, I'm really a landlubber, and I'm a terrible driver, and I'm just as bad in a kayak. So somehow I managed to convince my granddaughter to come with me, and the group moved ahead, and we kind of zigzagged going back and forth with the kayak because we couldn't go straight, and we were laughing our heads off. But I was able to see the bones of shipwrecks below the water, and I was able to see the rock wall, the cliff wall that has the pictographs that Indigenous people, Potawatomi, painted on there many, many centuries ago, many years ago.
That must have been so moving for you to see that.
It was, because I hadn't yet researched it, but when I talked to Dr. Patrick Young, who's an expert in the Potawatomi and the history of this area, and he was hypothesizing, really believing that these pictographs indicated a battle between the god of the water and the god of the sky, and the god of the sky is the Thunderers, and I could remember the shape of one of the in the pictograph looked a great deal like a Thunderer. So that to me felt right. It all settled into place when I heard that explanation.
We're talking about a new children's graphic novel. It's called Death's Door with Port Washington children's author Barbara Josie. And you can join in with your questions and comments along the way. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Barbara, at times Death's Door is a sympathetic character trying to warn people of the potential dangers. Why portray this deadly passage as sympathetic?
Well, he says in the very beginning, I am wind, I am water, I am rock so sharp they can tear a boat apart. I can't help what I am. I am Death's Door. So I thought to myself, how many times do we say, if these walls could talk? You think about your home that may have been owned by somebody else, or maybe even yourself. You think about a bar or a beauty parlor and all the stories that it's heard. And I thought, what if this passage knew those stories, but it is powerless to help. And It would be stoic, I think. I mean, then I tried to imagine what kind of personality it would have. And I thought it would be stoic, but it would have regrets because it would not want to have inflicted pain, but it couldn't help what it is. The message being, it is up to us to understand that the lake or anything like it has dangers inherent with it. And it's up to us to exercise caution and whatever protective measures we can.
When you explain the story of this monster battle at death's door told through Potawatomi families, you correct a narrative about Potawatomi families who crossed death's door somewhere between 1690 and 1763. How is the real story different from the myth?
Well, I guess that we have no proof of any of it. We really don't. People are guessing. I weighed in on this side of it because it made sense to me. The other part of this, the story that's often told about Death's Door, which is how Door County got its name, is that there were warring tribes that fooled each other. And one of the tribes caused the other to kind of come to an unsafe place, and many of the warriors drowned. That didn't feel right to me because I thought they were smarter than that. I don't think they would have fallen for that trick. And they were very brave, and they wouldn't have. I mean, some of the stories say that they captured some Potawatomi and tortured them, and they told that the others were coming. But I don't think that torture would have, those were very, very brave people. And I don't think torture would have caused them to fess up. So this one, that it be the story that I told, that was Dr. Young's story and corroborated by a couple of papers. It felt right to me. So the story I told is not warring tribes. It's about a trade party that left and stopped for a lunch on a cliff that was dry, and it was a sunny day. But we know Death's Door, a storm can come up very, very fast. And that's what happened. A storm came up, and they were trapped on this cliff and couldn't leave and couldn't get up the cliff. Dr. Young also described, well, I asked him some questions, you know, and I said, why did they, Well, he said they would put offerings of tobacco in the water as they were paddling. And I said, why? And he said, well, as a peace offering to Mishu Pishu, the god of the sea. And then I said, what happens if they don't offer a peace offering? Well, they could be consumed by the water, or there could be a storm between Mishu Pishu and the thunderers. And that's what he believed that the Potawatomi would have been thinking when the storm came up. It was a fight between the god of the sea and the god of the sky.
Was it difficult for you to find accurate information about Death's Door, considering that it is the focus of fables and tales?
It was real tough. It really was. And because I am writing in this case for Wisconsin Historical Society Press, they want everything to be proven as much as possible. They understood this, my interpretation of Death's Door and the Potawatomi was an interpretation, but there was no proof we could find anywhere that corroborated completely any of the stories. So I really had to dig to find any kind of evidence of the stories. And when you think about newspapers, today's newspapers have a pretty good standard of factual. But earlier newspapers wanted to tell a good story. So you really couldn't even count on that. There were lots of different places where I could find information, and I just dug everywhere.
Barbara Josie is a children's book author in Port Washington. Her new graphic novel for kids is called Death's Door, about dramatic moments in Great Lakes maritime history. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. You can share thoughts at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with children's book author and Wisconsin native Barbara Josie on crafting stories for young readers. Her new book is called Death's Door. It's about the narrow strip of water on Lake Michigan's shore between the peninsula of Door County and Washington Island, known for shipwrecks and treacherous storms. Call in with a question. Be part of the discussion. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Lisa in Milwaukee is here. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good morning. I love the title of your book, Now That I Know What You're Talking About. I was thinking you were going to talk about death. But I have a question for you. How are your children getting a hold of your books? Are they online? Are they on Kindle? What are they doing nowadays with books for children?
Thanks, Lisa.
These books are available in paperback only, and we designed it in paperback so that kids could stick it in their backpack, because that's what they like to do with books. But you can get them on, of course, Amazon and any local bookstore, and I think they'll be readily available in bookstores.
You know, and more here on your process and in the publishing, you know, more than 55 children's books now over the decades. How do you find an agent, a publisher who really believes in you and trusts your vision? How do you get that toehold?
Well, normally you would go through an agent, and I do have an agent. But in this case, the Historical Society Press had a relationship with the illustrator, Renee Grafe. And so Renee and I put our heads together and came up with this concept. And we went to the press, and they were delighted to have us as part of their team. We love working for the Wisconsin Historical Society Press because they give us a lot of creative freedom, but they are very, very strict about the facts being correct. And they have experts not only on the publishing team in the editorial area and marketing area, but they have people involved in the education for kids. So they understand standards. They suggested that we include a bibliography. I really thought, oh, what kid is going to read a bibliography? But their education experts say kids do. So having people who are very closely connected to the schools is super helpful.
Several of your books, including Death's Door, as you mentioned, are illustrated by Renee Grafe. What is your relationship like with illustrators? What is that collaboration like?
Normally, I don't have a relationship with an illustrator. I'm assigned an illustrator by the publisher. But in the case of Renee, she is really my best friend. And she groans when I call her. I called her yesterday and I said, oh, we're in trouble because my brain has gone AWOL. And when that happens, it usually means it's cooking up a new project. And she is in the process of moving. So she didn't need another new project. And she just groans. We're very, very tight. And we collaborate tightly on everything. So there's no word move that I make without consulting Renee. And there's no illustrative move that she does without consulting me. That said, I'm queen of the words, and she is queen of the illustrations.
You stay in your own lane, so to speak. What is your writing process like once you have a good story idea? What happens?
Well, when I said my brain is AWOL, I feel like when it's cooking up solutions and it's cooking up words and sentences and phrases, there is the narrowest strip of brain left for my day-to-day activity, and I do things like bump into things, and I have trouble sleeping, and I know that my brain is just working. I just let it go. And I recognize now those creative, juicy times when I just have to let it go. I can't push it. I can't try and write. But then I'll wake up and I'll have, is in the case of Death's Door, the very first sentences in the book were came to me very quickly. So I just kind of am in service to what my brain is cooking up.
Death's Door is your first graphic novel, though. Why publish a graphic novel?
Well, I've always wanted to. I mean, a story is a story, whether it's told by a campfire, whether it's read in a novel, whether it's told pictures only. And so you find a new genre. I mean, I've done children's theater, I've done musical, I've done music. All of those are ways to tell story. And this was a way I hadn't tried before, graphic novel. And so I thought, what are the differences? How can I use them? And I thought, by using separate panels, all of those make people children stop and think. So we have several areas in the book that are many, many panels for a single sentence, and that makes children stop. I also use words like listen, look, feel it, think. All of those make children, make the readers stop and assess. What would I do? What's happening here? Notice what's happening. So I tried to use the things that the graphic novel would offer me and use them to my advantage in the story I wanted to tell.
We are talking about the new children's graphic novel, Death's Door, with Port Washington author Barbara Josie. You can call in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Barbara, we heard from Rachel in Red Cliff called in and is wondering if you were able to speak with tribal members about the Potawatomi stories and the legends in your book.
Yes, I did call, and the Historical Society talked to the people at the Potawatomi Center, Library and Cultural Center, and they could not come up with something because this happened so long ago. There just were no records of what happened, so they kind of came up empty. So then that is when I turned to Dr. Young, who brought up letters and journal entries from people who had visited with a Potawatomi that seemed to corroborate the story that he tells.
Your books have been translated into 29 languages, and Ghost
Yes.
Wings was adapted into a bilingual play on the wings of a mariposa. Do you approach stories differently, knowing that they could be translated?
Yes, I think this book, Death's Door, would make the most wonderful play, sort of like Our Town. And I started out my writing actually writing neighborhood plays when I was a little girl. And I love theater. So occasionally I'll just come up with a story that I think this is really made for theater. And Death's Door is one. I would love to see this produced.
What were your neighborhood plays about growing up?
Oh, well, I did things like Aladdin's Lamp. And I mean, I would take a story that I knew and make it into a play. And of course, we used a bedspread curtain and stuff like that. And we charged the parents who paid for all the things that were in the play. And
Of course.
the other thing that I did was I had a partner in crime, Mike, who was my best friend at that time. Very creative guy. And he and I cooked up schemes and dreams and charged the little kids money to do all of them. For example, we created the Land of Green Ginger, which was a trail along the woods into the swamp and into onto an island that had a blood bug tree. So we would take the kids and charge them to take a tour. And one of us would be sound effects. So we would hide in the woods and we would make spooky sounds while the other one took the kids on tour. But what that made us do is, in order to get the kids to to pay each time, not just once, but more times, we had to change the story. So we were constantly thinking in terms of story. I didn't know that writing was a thing. I just didn't even know it. I didn't have a library in my school, and I didn't have one in my town, Grafton, until I was in probably around seventh grade. So I didn't understand really what fiction books were like. I was in a Catholic school and all the books were about saints and they didn't sound like me. So I ended up just creating story constantly in my mind, not knowing that that was kind of a pre-writing exercise.
Barbara Josie is a children's book author in Port Washington. New graphic novel called Death's Door, Stories Capturing Moments in Great Lakes Maritime History. Join in the discussion. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. What a pleasure to have Wisconsin author Barbara Josie, who has written more than 55 books for children, translated into dozens of languages. Latest one is called Death's Door, featuring two stories about the stretch of water near Lake Michigan's notoriously treacherous western shore. Call in with a question or comments for a children's author, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Alan in Menominee is here. Hi, Alan.
Good morning.
Good morning. Go ahead.
Well, I'm a former scuba diver, and I had one commercial stint to help pay my way through college, and I dove on what you formerly was the telephone line that connected the mainland with Washington Island. And it went out through a couple other islands to get there. One of them was a small Coast Guard island. And that I can tell you that there are currents in Death's Door. It's like scuba diving in a river. And at that time, it was a clear river. We could see 100 feet or more. And the current would change without warning. You might be swimming into the corner kind of quartering in it to go to on a straight angle. And we would follow this cable, which had a malfunction. It wasn't working anymore. And they were looking, it was the first repair job of a underwater telephone line probably in the world. And the current, I was shocked at times swimming, how the current would change. And it would even take rocks on the floor of Lake Michigan, whether you were swimming in 90 feet or 100 feet or 80 feet of water through there.
Wow. Alan, thank you for describing what that feels like. Barbara, what comes up for you?
Yeah. Wow. It makes you think about the people who lived on Washington Island or one of the other islands. You know, it isn't just about shipping that took that treacherous passage. Imagine, and this is what I ask children to imagine you're living on the island and you have no connection. I mean, this is a phone line. I don't know when the phones came in, but of course there were centuries where there was no phone line, no access to mail. Nobody could cross what they called the Crystal Bridge. In the wintertime, it's easy enough and, well, difficult, but possible in the summer. But in the winter, it's ice. So do you walk it? And what happens in the spring when the ice is soft? So to be isolated on Washington Island is really, really, it's a little bitty island. And even now, there aren't many people. The graduating classes are maybe four children. So imagine if you lived on one of those remote islands and you had no way to get supplies or communication with anybody on the peninsula. Ellen, that's so dramatic. I'm so glad you told that story.
There's a story about a mail carrier who delivers goods to remote islanders. What is this story in your book?
Oh, I got this story in a crazy place. It was the story of mail carriers of Washington Island. Now, that's kind of an obscure publication, but it had, in the words of the mail carriers, their experiences. There were so many stories. So for a long time, the U.S. Postal Service didn't have a mail carrier. So in the case of Henry Miner, the people on Washington Island asked him, after being isolated for most of the winter, to please pick up the mail and supplies in Sheboygan, or I'm sorry. In Green Bay. Green so Bay. He had to go by foot with his sled from between minus 23 degrees and minus 30 degrees, 6 to 7 days on foot over the Crystal Bridge through the snow. And he used his own words to describe that was one of the lucky places where I found, I mean, that's a pretty good a resource when you can find it in the words of the person who experienced it. And he had stops along the way that he could make and stay overnight. When he got to Green Bay, he packed the sled, but it was a big blizzard. And everybody said, don't go. But Henry said, well, I'm going to go because I want to make church in time. So he took off minus 30 degrees and had to plow. You know what it's like to go through fresh snow. It's exhausting. And in his words, I know that he was eating fat pork and molasses because he'd learned that that keeps your energy up. Taking a sled full of supplies so that the people on Washington Island could get the things they needed, and a little bit of news from the newspaper and some letters. So they pitched in and paid him $20 for that trip.
Mm.
It's an amazing trip, and I won't tell how it ends because it's a big surprise, and it shows the character of the people. You know?
Well, the character of the people, but the first cabin he arrives at, when he's so cold and frigid, they weren't welcoming. And you know, that was even hard for me as an adult to accept.
Right.
Yeah.
I know.
How could that be? Yes.
Right? I know. Well, it wasn't the first. He'd gone without incident, except for minus 23 degrees. He got through the first three stops. Then when he got to Green Bay and packed up, now he's headed back in the storm, and just, he can't go further. And he describes how he's exhausted and his legs give out. So he falls in the snow, but you know, when you fall in the snow and it gets cold, this feeling comes over you that it's a pleasant thing. And you could just take a little rest, a little snooze, and you'll be all right. And it's a trickery of the cold that numbs you to have that thought. So he knew that he couldn't rest. So he's too tired to go on. So he claws his way through the snow with his mittened hands. Then he sees a cabin ahead, and he's excited. Maybe he anticipates a nice dinner and resting by the fire. He gets to the cabin and the men are fighting inside and they won't let him in.
Hmm. Barbara Josie of Port Washington, new novel is Death's Door, a children's graphic novel. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Joe in Hillsborough is here. Joe, hi.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm a pilot, and I've flown into Washington Island on numerous occasions. There's a small grass strip there. And one of the things that I love about that area, particularly Washington Island, is as you take off, you're almost immediately over the water. But just off the coast of Washington Island, there are visibly two shipwrecks that are on the bottom. of the waters, and I think it's kind of testament as to, you know, how difficult navigation was and the trickery of being in that area on the water.
Wow, Joe, and you can see those shipwrecks visible to the eye from the air.
Yes, it's kind of fun to see them.
Wow. Well, thank you so much for calling in. You know, it reminds me, Barbara, of your story of a character who is a female shipbuilder. And
yes.
You write about how her work goes unrecognized. Can you talk a little bit about the story of shipbuilding in Death's Door?
Well, in this case, this is a ship built by a couple called the Clows. And in those days, of course, I mean, it took a little digging to find out that Sarah Clow was one of the two shipbuilders. She and her husband, David, were the shipbuilders. But she's not mentioned. It's usually David Clow, Captain David Clow, David Clow. But I dug a little bit deeper and found out that there were two people who built the boat. And consider, they were on Chambers Island, two of them. They were the only family on the whole island. Every single thing that was on this schooner was built by hand by these two people. And Sarah also had seven children, and she had to grow the crops. She had to take care of the children in the household, and they were apparently quite a jolly couple. They loved to laugh and really, really loved each other. But in those days, a woman isn't mentioned. Now, one of the things I thought was interesting was I know that they had to use this kind of a saw, which is a log that is suspended on a trestle. And one person stands on top with a saw, and their partners is on the bottom. So they're going up and down with the saw. But Sarah was on the top because David was quite a large man and he wouldn't have been able to stand on the top. They did everything. They even built the nails called trenails that are pieces of wood. Everything came from that island and they did it themselves, all by themselves.
Can you, what must have been like, and I think there's an illustration of this, but just seeing that boat sail for the first time and seeing all of those years of work coming to fruition.
Yes. And if you read the back matter, it describes what happens to that boat later on. It's stuck. It gets stuck in a swamp because a storm pushes it into a swamp, but David refuses to give up. So he finds a way to dig out of that swamp and get the boat back on course. There was so much pride in that kind of a ship that I can imagine. And this book, Death's Door, is certainly about a passage. And I love the two men who called in and describing what that passage is like. But more, it's about the people who created the foundation or the bedrock of our state. They're resourceful, brave, sometimes greedy, sometimes heartless. But you read that book and you get a good cross-section or a mosaic of the people who formed the bedrock of our state.
Children's book author and Wisconsin native Barbara Josie, our guide to the craft of writing for young audiences and her latest graphic novel, Death's Door. Call in with the question. Be part of the discussion at any point, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We peek into the creative world of Port Washington children's author Barbara Josie, who finds inspiration in watching the waves on Lake Michigan and walking its shores. Barbara's new graphic novel, Death's Door, depicts dramatic moments from Great Lakes maritime history. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Barbara, a tragic story in the book is about cabin fever, this team of Washington Island basketball players who die crossing the passage in winter. And then a steel-hulled ferry is then built to ensure safer passage. How significant is this ferry?
Well, it's the lifeline for Washington Island. As you read that story, I mean, it's late winter and early spring, which is the most dangerous time. I mean, if it's full out winter, you could probably cross safely, cross the Crystal Bridge or the ice safely. But when the ice starts to melt, there are slushy spots and you can fall through the ice. But things can drive people out. And one of them drove people out, off of the island was cabin fever. They wanted to experience something new. And that's one of the places where I relate it to kids. Let's see if I can find that place. It says, oh, now this is 1935, and it's the Washington Island men's basketball team. So we use several little panels to give you the feeling of cabin fever, which I think kids can identify with. Mm-hmm. Feel it. The creepy crawlies, like mosquitoes buzzing under your skin, like you can't stand one more minute on the island, one more minute of cold, one more minute staring at the walls of your room. The islanders call it cabin fever, a kind of winter madness, a hunger for adventure, just as real as the hunger for food. It makes people burst out of their homes, their safe places, for adventure, for fun, for something new. So I describe this familiar feeling to kids and have the islanders, which is what the basketball team was called, leave the island in a group of cars all together, caravan, and get safely to the peninsula. Traveling back, a terrible accident happens and the men enter death's door. They fall through the ice and enter death's door. That was a huge loss for the island because they're so tight. And as I say in the book, on an island this small, everyone is neighbors and every neighbor is a friend. Hmm. So there's a big grieving for these men that had to be treated very sensitively because the descendants of these men are still on the island. But you are not going to change that feeling of needing to go out or wanting to go out and get off the island. So what can change? Again, you're not going to change death's door. You're not going to change the passage. You can change the way you cross on the passage. And so the ferry was created that with a front that could break through the ice. And now it's safe to travel on the ferry across death's door. It's we who have to change, not nature.
You mentioned how this is still a sensitive subject on the island, even today. How do you broach that trauma as you write, and talk about the family's descendants?
Well, you have to tell the truth. The men died. But I treated it in, I think, a pretty sensitive way. I'll find that place. Okay. But they never make it home. A search party spies their tire tracks and follows them to a hole in the ice. All six men have entered death's door. On tiny Washington Island, everyone is a neighbor, and every neighbor is a friend. The loss of even one is a loss for all. Listen. Whoosh. This is the sound of the island crying. The people and the trees and the beasts all mourning for the friends they lost. That is the howl of my wind, for I am crying too. So to show mourning, to show feelings of this passage that couldn't help what it is, that was my way to handle this and let the islanders know that it was a tender thing to have lost these friends and neighbors. But it is also the truth. That's what happened. So that's the way I treated it.
You walk along Lake Michigan nearly every day and your windows look out to the lake. You write about the lake. You embrace it. What should people know about Lake Michigan?
It's the most exciting place I can imagine. I can't imagine ever not living beside it anymore. And it has so many moods. Every single day is different, but you cannot take it for granted. It has dangers to it. And when the weather says gale warning, when it's hazardous to go out into the water, you should not. I have a brother who's a crazy guy, and he fights wind and water, or he says he plays with it every day, almost every day. He does almost all of the wind water things there are to do. But he's very respectful of what the lake is and what it will do. And he takes precautions for that reason. He doesn't stop playing with the lake, but he's careful about it. And you have to be. There are too many deaths. Oh, I've also created a shipwreck walking tour along Lake Michigan because the stories are so dramatic. So it's an app-based program. You start at the light station.
Mm-hmm.
And you download it to your phone. And my crazy brother and I, Don and I, are the voices on the tour. And I take you through a number of shipwrecks along Port Washington's coast in dramatic way. It's sort of like a radio play with sound effects, fog horns and things like that.
Maybe harkens back to your youth just a tiny bit.
Yeah, right?
Right. Do you consider your stories a form of conservation for Lake Michigan?
Yes.
and natural waters?
Absolutely. I feel so strongly. It's such a beautiful, mysterious, it is like a person to me. I'm imagining another story that I want to write. This would be a kid's novel about one of the shipwrecks that happened right outside of the very center of Port Washington. And I think I'm going to call it Frozen Charlotte is the new working title that I have for it. So the lake, it never stops surprising me. Oh, I have to say this. I was walking, this was a couple weeks ago, and I got to the bird sanctuary and I looked down at our south beach and I was with my friend, Mary, my walking partner. And I said, what's that? I couldn't recognize what it was. So I took my phone and I enlarged the lens, took a picture and then enlarged the picture. And I said, I think they're flamingos. We got down to, and that's what they were.
Indeed.
I don't think anyone had seen them at that point. There were three people on the beach.
Yeah.
Two women were reading and weren't looking up, and one little child was digging in the sand. So I think they maybe just landed.
And lo and behold, those news reports, you never know. Well, Barbara,
never know.
What a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Barbara Josie of Port Washington is the author of more than 55 children's books. Her new one, it's called Death's Door, True Tales of Tragedy, Mystery, and Bravery from the Great Lakes' Most Dangerous Waters. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about estate planning now and ensuring assets go where you intend them after death, and how to successfully create a valid will under Wisconsin laws to avoid the probate process. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel Ringy is a partner at Hill Glowacki. That's a Madison law firm with practice areas in estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. Chantel, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much, Kate.
So when a family member passes away without a will or an estate plan and the distribution of their assets usually determined by the probate court process, why do attorneys recommend strategies for avoiding probate?
Well, I don't know that I've ever met a client who was very excited to have to petition the court. That said, our Dane County commissioners are very friendly and relatively easy to deal with in my experience. But I think there's something about the court process that adds this sort of extra layer of stress for many folks. And if they can avoid that, or if my clients can know that their loved ones can avoid that upon their passing, then generally with a bit of planning, we're able to accomplish that.
Is probate a concern only for large estates, or is it a concern at all levels?
Probate is in Wisconsin a court proceeding that's required when there are assets that total in value $50,000 or more that don't otherwise pass by, let's say, joint ownership. For example, if you have a joint account and it's held with survivorship with the other owner, then that will pass automatically without the need for any kind of administration. Or assets that pass automatically because you've named a beneficiary to receive it and that beneficiary survives you. But otherwise, if you have at least $50,000 of assets that don't otherwise pass that way, then Wisconsin law does require the probate proceeding.
What factors might complicate a probate case and might be frustrating for surviving family members?
Well, it does involve, by statute, the publication of notice to creditors in the paper. So there's a legal notice that's published in the state journal if the person passed away in Dane County. And heirs at law need to be notified of the proceedings, and those persons may not be beneficiaries under the will or under the they would be under the rules of intestacy, but if you have a will, it doesn't mean that you've named your heirs, but yet in a probate proceeding, those persons must be notified. So, for instance, if you've named your unmarried partner or charities and excluded your heirs, nevertheless, if a probate is required, those persons need to receive a copy of the will, and they do have an opportunity to object to the proceedings. That's not always something that my clients like the idea of.
So it becomes a much more public process, as you said before.
It does. And there is an entry on the Wisconsin CCAP website. One could discern, I suppose, the size of the estate even from the inventory fee that's paid, and that is public.
We're talking about estate planning and alternatives to probate court with a Madison attorney. Chantel Ringy is here fielding your questions and comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel, a deceased family member could have a written legal will and their family could still have to go through probate to settle the estate. What might be the cause of those situations?
That's exactly right. So, having a will is something that hopefully we all consider and do. It's sort of a very basic fundamental step in planning for how your assets are distributed upon your death and who is going to handle that. But having a will alone does not allow you to avoid probate necessarily. Again, the trigger would be if you have assets that don't pass automatically. That total 50,000. So those are the situations in which maybe you would like to consider establishing something beyond just a basic will. If you're motivated to allow your beneficiaries to avoid the probate process, then you might consider something along the lines of a revocable trust, which is also a very common estate planning tool, and really its sole purpose is to avoid probate of your assets upon your death. It's kind of this legal fiction, the revocable trust. It is essentially if you direct assets to your revocable trust, perhaps during your lifetime by titling assets in the name of the trust, and also oftentimes upon your death by designating the trust as the beneficiary on beneficiary designation forms. then those assets that are in your revocable trust upon your passing are not in your probate estate. And so according to this, as I say, legal fiction, those assets get to avoid probate. So that's kind of in a nutshell, the structure of the revocable trust type of planning, which, as I say, is fairly simple to establish, and it's a pretty common estate planning tool. Many of my clients, once they learn of that option, are interested in pursuing it, and it's designed to avoid probate.
Then,
so having a will alone is just is not sufficient, unfortunately, to avoid the probate process.
And then how is a revocable trust or a living trust different from what is happening in the will?
So generally, the revocable trust will contain many of the similar provisions that you might have still in your will. They'll have the substantive provisions regarding who's to receive what upon your passing. But essentially, it is just designed to avoid probate. And I think the impetus behind the allowance to avoid probate in our statutes is just this notion that if you've done enough planning on the front end to avoid the process of probate, then our legislature feels that, okay, we can take a more hands-off approach. In the event of your death, we will allow the individual you've designated to serve as your successor trustee to administer those assets outside of the jurisdiction, the oversight of the probate court.
Let's bring on a call now. Laura in Grand Marsh. Laura, go ahead.
Yes, I'm trying to get these things settled with regards to will and trust. But what my concern right now is I wanted to know, my husband is concerned that if I pass away, how would he handle his finances? So I wanted to set up a durable power of attorney for finances. Can I do that on my own, or do I need an attorney to do that?
Laura, thank you. And if you could step back also for a moment, Chantel, and explain what a durable power of attorney is, what this person does.
That is an excellent question, Laura. A durable power of attorney is generally regarded as something that would allow an agent to manage your financial affairs, but it only applies while you're living. That's true with regard to the healthcare power of attorney as well. So, Laura, your husband's concern with respect to what he would do if you were to pass away would not really be alleviated by your establishing a financial durable power of attorney, because, again, that type of form expires, so to speak, upon your death. So having something like a will or a trust would be something you'd want to pursue. At the same time, I don't want to slight the planning that is involved in establishing powers of attorney, because those are excellent documents to have in place if you are living and you suffer an incapacity, such as dementia or a stroke or some sort of acute emergency situation. It's in that context in which the agent who's designated under your durable power of attorney for finances would have authority to do things like access your bank accounts to pay your bills, file income tax returns on your behalf, contract on your behalf, and maybe apply for Medicaid. In terms of the question, Laura, that you have, do you need to work with an attorney to establish a durable power of attorney for finances? The answer is no, you do not have to. There is a statutory form in Wisconsin for a durable power of attorney for finances. The downside of not working with an attorney and just using the state form is that if you ever do have a real long-term disabling condition, that statutory form unfortunately lacks many of the planning authorities that we rely on at Hill Glowacki, for instance, to help the agent do things like maybe qualify you for long-term care Medicaid benefits. Mm-hmm. And those additional authorities can be extremely helpful. Another type might be to include the authority to create a special needs trust on your behalf. You're not going to find those authorities in the statutory form. So while having that statutory form is better than having nothing, and it is free, you just really need a notary to notarize your signature. It's of limited value depending on your circumstances.
Chantel Ringy is a Madison-based attorney focused on estate planning and elder law, special needs planning. You can join the conversation at any point, calling in with a question, sharing your comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the set of legal documents that outline how a person's assets will be distributed upon death. And you can be part of this conversation about estate planning and how to protect and pass down assets to family members. Call in with a question, add comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Chantel Ringy, who is a partner at Hill Glowacki in Madison. Chantel, parents can designate guardians of their minor children in the event of their death, and people who have lost a spouse can give power of attorney to an adult child to make healthcare or financial decisions for the surviving parent. At what stage of life do you recommend people start the estate planning process?
Well, I think you touched on what I've always regarded as the most important time of life to establish your estate plan, or at least some form of estate planning, and that is if you have children. So in Wisconsin, the only place you can designate a successor guardian for a minor child is in your will. The same is true if you're the guardian of a special needs adult child. You can designate or nominate, I should say. It still needs to be approved by the court, but you can make that nomination within your will. And what's more important planning than trying to ensure that your child has as streamlined of a handoff as possible in the event of your unfortunate passing? So that is extremely important. The other time of another instance might be I kind of hit on it. If you have an individual who is going to be a beneficiary of your estate and they have special needs, that's another occasion in which it can be very helpful to do some planning in advance so that when they receive whatever it might be from your estate, it doesn't, for instance, jeopardize their eligibility for perhaps public benefits that they're reliant upon. And to also make sure that there's someone who is able to administer those assets for their benefit. We do prepare in those instances special needs trusts for such beneficiaries. So that's another occasion when it can be extremely helpful and important to do a bit of planning on the front end.
As you bring up these scenarios, it makes me wonder, like, is it permissible to shop around or inquire how much it will cost to set up these specific things or an estate plan? Or how do you find the expertise you need for your situation?
That's a good question. So yes, I think it should be encouraged that consumers shop around, get an idea for, is this really in the wheelhouse for the attorney who you're considering doing the planning with? What is a ballpark of their fees? And what are you getting for those fees? A good resource is the Wisconsin chapter of the National Association of Elder Law Attorneys. The vast majority of those members are very invested in estate planning as part of their practice area. And they do have a directory online that you can find with just a Google search. But there are many well-qualified attorneys in our area who do estate planning. But certainly call around, get an idea of the cost. Don't walk into it blindly. And take some recommendations from family members or friends as well who maybe have gone through the process recently themselves.
Let's bring in Phyllis in Wausau with a question. Hi, Phyllis.
Hello.
What would you like to ask?
Okay. My question is, I have a friend who died recently with no close kin, no will, no nothing. How is that property handled? You know, what is the process?
Those can be very difficult cases, not necessarily because of the assets that need to be administered. But for instance, I have a very similar situation in one of my client matters at the law firm now, and woman passed away and she had no relatives in the area. And the she did have a will, but no one really knew any of the named beneficiaries. And so sometimes that means we're hiring an air search firm to locate people, or sometimes we at the law firm are doing quite a bit of online searching and making phone calls blindly to try to find who are the interested persons. If the person has no will, then essentially the state of Wisconsin has established an estate plan for them in our statutes, the rules of intestacy. So generally, if a person passes away with no surviving spouse and no surviving descendants, then you're looking at, do they have surviving parents? Perhaps not. If not, then you're looking at who are their surviving siblings and the descendants of any predeceased siblings. So you can imagine situations in which we're going pretty far down the chain and really trying to locate people who have no idea who the decedent is or maybe never met him or her. So those are the cases where I really do encourage folks who have maybe charitable intentions or a very friendly neighbor who's always helped out, right? You know, establish an estate plan and designate who you really do want your assets to pass to, whatever it may be, large or small, because even if it's, you know, $50,000 in your bank account, it could mean a fair amount of work for whoever is left to handle the affairs. And in the case that I have in my office right now, it's the legal guardian of the woman when she passed away who's handling the administration of the estate, just because she's a third party, just a retired attorney, but she was most familiar with the woman's affairs. And so she's the one who's kind of taking the rowing oar. They can be difficult situations.
We're discussing estate planning, all aspects of it, with Madison attorney Chantel Ringy, and taking your calls. Let's go to Alicia in Little Chute. Alicia, hi. What would you like to bring up?
I have a complex situation. I have two children, a son and a daughter. And the son has been diagnosed as bipolar, seasonal affective schizophrenic, possibly. He's terrible at handling money. The other one can handle the money, and I'm not sure, you know, I can do well, and it's kind of, you know, I'm kind of a 50-50 person for my children, adult children, and I'm not sure how to handle his portion, because if he would get it, it would be gone in a heartbeat.
Alicia, I want to toss this over to Chantel to get your thoughts in a situation like this, Chantel.
Alicia, you're not alone in your situation and your concerns. We have many clients who have a loved one who they would ideally like to benefit in their estate plan, but their loved one has some special needs or some inability to manage funds. When that's the case, we generally recommend a special needs trust. What that would allow is for you to appoint the person or organization to manage your son's, in this instance, share of your estate after your passing. So that, as you say, he's not spending it without regard for his long-term well-being. So you have a trustee who's in charge of administering the assets for the benefit of the special needs person. The other thing that that trustee should be aware of
very quickly
is what will distributions do in the way of affecting his eligibility for things like Medicaid.
And I'm going to just jump in here, Chantel Ringy, attorney, and you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. When a person dies, we learn about the process to transfer their property and other assets with estate planning tools that can help avoid probate. A Wisconsin attorney fields your questions about estate planning and call in to be part of the discussion. Add your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel Ringy works on cases involving estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. Chantel, once you do set up your documents and have those intentions, in those legal areas, those legal documents, how do you suggest communicating that information to loved ones or, you know, multiple kids?
So what I typically recommend is that certainly you first make sure that whoever the persons are who you're naming as agent, you know, to serve in various capacities in the event of your incapacity or your passing, that you talk with them first, make sure that they feel comfortable serving in that position, and ultimately that they know that they've been named. I also always recommend that clients provide a copy of their healthcare directives to their nominated healthcare agents in case they're ever called upon in the event of an emergency to make, you know, quick healthcare decisions for you. Beyond that, our names are generally, the firm name is generally included on the documents themselves, so that if your, let's say, adult child locates your documents, and they should be told where they are. If they're in a safe deposit box at your bank, hopefully the child is named as an authorized person to access that box and they know where the keys are. Or if they're in a lockbox in your basement, hopefully they know where the key to that is or the code to get in. So let your agents know where the documents are so that they can be found if necessary, and make sure that they have a copy of your healthcare directive. So your doctor's office should also get a copy of your healthcare directive so that they know, or the emergency room knows if you end up there, who your agents are who should be contacted.
Christine emailed in to ask about a life estate. Christine established a life estate for their house and heard that the state of Wisconsin will claim part of this money if they need nursing home care in the future. And Christine's wondering how much of the value of their home would the state receive?
That is a question that I cannot answer without more information. And it really won't be discernible until their passing. And if she's married, if Christine is married, then it won't be until the passing of her and her spouse. It is correct. So a life estate, backing up, is this notion that you are transferring a future interest in your home, but you're preserving for yourself the right to live there as long as you're alive and prefer to live there. Or can live there. And so the owner has this retained interest, and it used to be that if you received long-term care Medicaid benefits during your lifetime and you had this life estate, when you passed away, the life estate interest went away and Medicaid's estate recovery rights could not apply to that life estate interest. But I believe it was 2014 when our statutes changed in that regard. Medicaid's estate recovery rights were broadened. And one of the things that became subject to their right of recovery are life estates. And so that's correct. If you have a life estate that was established after, I believe it's August 1st of 2014, and if you've received long-term care Medicaid benefits or your spouse has, then there is likely to be some claim against that interest in the event of your death. The idea being, of course, this is a publicly funded program, and the federal government, in fact, I think mandates that our state government attempt to recover what it can from assets that remain from in the beneficiary's estate when they pass.
How do survivors deal with outstanding debts left by a deceased family member, especially in the situation of too little money remains in the estate to pay down the debt?
That's a good question. So our statutes do dictate sort of an order of priority when it comes to various creditors. And as you might imagine, the government is generally at the top of that list. Mm-hmm. So things like Medicaid or tax debt, you know, those types of debts certainly do take priority over a beneficiary's right to inherit, with some exceptions, I should say. But generally speaking, that's the case. Unsecured creditors, when there isn't enough money to go around, oftentimes they don't receive anything. And so that's part of the impetus behind the requirement to file the notice to creditors in the newspaper so that creditors at large, even if you don't know about who the creditors of your loved one might be, they have an opportunity and in many cases an obligation to file a claim so that they can be identified. And if there's an opportunity with money remaining to negotiate a reduced payback, perhaps their claim could be resolved. But otherwise, there are instances when if there's no money there, there's nothing to pay the creditors. And so, unfortunately, they are not always paid.
We're talking about estate planning and the probate process with Madison attorney Chantel Ringy. You can join in with questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Valerie is with us in Madison. Valerie, hi. Go ahead.
Hi. I recently responded to a mailing solicitation to attend an estate planning workshop at which a free meal at a nice restaurant would be offered. And I researched a little bit behind the firm and found out that the attorney was licensed in Illinois, not Wisconsin. So I contacted the firm, and the attorney responded saying that they wrote up documents using a Zoom call with a licensed Wisconsin attorney. So I was just wondering about the, you know, about that whole situation.
Thanks, Valerie. Chantel, what are the implications of borderlines in a situation like that?
Well, the best advice is to have an estate planning meeting and have your estate plan drafted by and with an attorney who is licensed in the state where you reside. So maybe in that situation, there are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, it sounds like, and perhaps some of it has to do with who's better at marketing than the other. But you know, most people, I think, want to sit down with their estate planning attorney. It's during those discussions that so many important points arise. And if that attorney with whom you're having that meaningful discussion with is not licensed in the state of your residence, then they may be missing planning opportunities or other things that would jump out to someone who is. Someone who's licensed in Illinois could not prepare, for instance, a marital property agreement for someone in Wisconsin. And we often do prepare, in the context of an estate plan, a marital property agreement that can have a lot of value to the overall estate. I mean, Illinois is not a marital property state like Wisconsin is. And so there are certainly nuances in the laws between states, and it is very important that you meet with and do your planning with an attorney who's licensed where you live.
Along those lines, you know, how portable is your estate plan, for instance, if you do move to another state?
Good question. So just because you've relocated to a new state does not mean that you need to toss out your old documents and have an entirely new estate plan. But that is definitely an occasion when you should plan to sit down with an attorney, blow the dust off of your old state estate plan, and determine whether there are some updates that should be made. And if it's because of Wisconsin's very unique marital property laws, there are occasions when updates are warranted, or when someone's moving to Wisconsin from another state, you know, vice versa, when updates could be made that could be helpful. So that is one of the times of life, or one of the events of life, I should say, when meeting with an estate planning attorney to discuss any recommended updates is helpful.
Sandy has emailed in to ask, what are the initial steps to follow when a spouse dies, assuming that a will or an estate plan is established?
So one of the initial steps would be to review the estate plan. And oftentimes, when it's a spousal situation, so there's a surviving spouse, there usually often is no need for an actual probate proceeding because many times most or all assets are set up in a way that they're either held jointly with the surviving spouse or the surviving spouse was named as the beneficiary. And it sounds like this is an occasion when there was some planning done. So hopefully that's the case. Maybe you have a trust established already. It would probably warrant picking up the phone and giving a call to the attorney who drafted or the law firm that drafted the estate plan to just let them know that your spouse has passed, and get some pointers in terms of maybe who to call in the way of making claims on assets or things that could be cleaned up. But when you've done planning, hopefully it's a short list and just a matter of, as I say, making phone calls and not necessarily the case that you're going to have to petition the probate court.
There are online tools, as you know, for writing wills and other estate planning documents. Are there risks of filling out forms through these types of online services without the help of an attorney?
I think it's great that there are online tools available. I think the goal is to help meet a need that certainly exists. And some people don't have funds to sit down with an attorney, or for whatever reason, don't choose to do that. When that's not the case, when you do have some wealth, or when you do have what you know to be a complicated situation, like our caller earlier with the beneficiary with disabilities, those are situations in which it really does help to, it really does add value to have that conversation with a lawyer because unfortunately, many of the online tools are set up in a way that they're sort of one size fits all, and you're not going to get the planning that might really be helpful for your loved one. And sometimes, even when you think what you need is just a simple will, what you might be getting is not exactly what you intend. I mean, there is a reason why law school is 3 years and grueling. We do learn a lot in that process.
Chantel Ringy is an attorney in Madison, works on estate planning, elder law, and special needs planning. You can join the conversation at any point. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the transfer of assets after death and different facets of estate planning here in Wisconsin. And you can call in with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Chantel Ringy is a partner at the Madison law firm Hale Glowacki. Let's go to Leisha now in Spring Green. Leisha, hi, go ahead.
Hi, my brother passed away unexpectedly in early 2021, and he didn't leave a will, and so I had to go through Dane County probate. I'm in Sauk County, and I probably went there at least four times, and depending on who I talked to, some of the people I talked to there were wonderful, and others were not helpful at all, and I had a terrible time. I got through about two-thirds of it, and I finally got to a point where I consulted with an attorney. I hired an attorney, and they told me that I didn't have to do a final accounting, and I showed up at Dane County Probate, and they said, oh, yes, you absolutely do. So I had to go back home and do all that, and he had quite a bit in his estate and was quite a process, and so I paid that attorney $600 for bad information, and it really bothered me a lot.
Leisha, thank you for sharing such a personal story. And Chantel, what do you make of a story like that and having to go through a process that is so unexpected and certainly not something that people understand?
Yes, it can be frustrating. It can be a long, drawn-out process, and certainly it's filled with various documents that the probate court requires you to submit. And I don't know that I've ever had two probates that are the same. There are occasions when you can avoid the accounting requirement, but you need all of the beneficiaries to waive that properly in writing. But, you know, there's the inventory that you need to file. There's generally a final accounting, and then they want to make sure that you've done all necessary income tax filings. So there's a certificate that they want to see from the state of Wisconsin that attests to that. You know, there is an inventory fee that you need to pay the probate court. It's relatively small, but it is based on the size of the estate. So as Leisha said, when you have a larger estate, as in her case, you're going to have a larger inventory fee, and all of those things sort of compound to make a stressful situation in which you might be trying to grieve the loss of your loved one even more difficult. Not that they're trying to make it difficult for you, but you will hear from the folks at the Dane County Probate Court repeatedly that they are not lawyers and they do not, they're not authorized to give legal advice. And so I'm sorry to hear that you did not receive good legal advice or legal advice that was relevant for your situation, Leisha. But it generally can be very helpful to make a phone call to an attorney to just find out what it is that you need to complete and maybe get some help completing those documents if you need assistance. I'm sorry to hear about that experience. Yes, if he had done a bit of planning, then you probably could have avoided that.
Let's bring in Richard now in Milwaukee. Richard, hi. Richard, are you there?
I'm sorry to hear about that experience.
Okay, Richard, I don't think is there anymore. Is wondering who decides jurisdiction for legal documents, especially if you've moved?
So in terms of which state has jurisdiction, the probate, if you need a probate, that will be in the county where you passed away. Mm-hmm. So we frequently receive phone calls from loved ones who reside outside of Wisconsin, but their family member or friend passed away in the state, and they're having to open a probate in Wisconsin. Sometimes if you have real estate in multiple states, that might mean you have multiple probates too, which, you know, that definitely makes it even more valuable to have planning done in advance to avoid that process. So it's the county where the decedent resided when they passed away that has jurisdiction of any probate. If they have documents drafted in another state, then generally the substantive provisions of those laws, that state's laws, apply, but the procedural laws of the state where you died apply in order to determine what procedures are required. So it can be kind of a mashup of the laws that apply in those situations.
Let's bring a question about wills now. Jeremy in Bayfield. Jeremy, hi.
Hi. I got a question that's related to copies of wills. My sister and brother and I are named as beneficiaries in a will, but there is no, we can't find the original will, and so the attorney that drew up the will has a copy, and I'm just wondering if we need to get a lawyer besides him to make sure that that the copy of the will is validated, because there's a person that who's not named a sister of the deceased who may contest the whole thing.
Jeremy, thank you. Chantel, what about the validity of the will and copies?
So in Wisconsin, the probate courts will generally want to see the original of the will, and that's what they prefer to admit to probate. If that cannot be located, and certainly there are situations in which that's the case, maybe there was a fire or the individual moved numerous times or it just simply was displaced, then there is there are occasions when the probate court will accept a copy for admission to probate, but you have to convince them that it's valid and that the original wasn't revoked, because one manner of revoking a will is by destroying it. So who's to say that it wasn't destroyed, right? So usually, for instance, in Dane County, when we have situations where the original will cannot be located, certainly you want to make your best effort to find it, first of all, checking all of the sort of usual places. It sounds like you called the attorney who drafted the will. That's great. But when it can't be found in Dane County, if we submit an affidavit, you know, a sworn statement that it's that the copy is believed to be the will that was still in effect at the time of death, and that you've attempted to locate the original, unless there's a contest, then generally our probate court will accept that. But it sounds like maybe there's someone who perhaps would object. And it's in those cases where it becomes potentially more of a protracted argument about whether it is in fact the will that was in force at the time of death.
We only have a few seconds left. On wills, does Wisconsin recognize handwritten wills?
Wisconsin does. What our law wants to see, though, is that you have two disinterested witnesses who have watched the testator, or testatrix, the person signing the will, sign and have also signed it themselves.
Chantel, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Chantel Ringy is a partner at the Madison law firm Hill Glowacki, with practice areas that involve estate planning, that involve elder law and special needs planning. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.